Hello, and welcome back to another edition of Indiepocalypse Radio, your weekly show about, you know, Indiepocalypse, the developers there within, and all the other things around Indiepocalypse. Hi, I'm your host, Andrew. I'm committing the cardinal sin of working on the weekend, doing something, but it's sometimes work needs to get done, and it needs to get done immediately. But for like a good hour or so, we're going to put away that work into a thing that I think is less work and more play adjacent, which is the show. And speaking of the show and speaking of play adjacent, games are kind of, in a way, play adjacent. And we've got a guest here who, I guess, made a game as well, which is, I don't know. Game adjacent, who knows what, like, listen, I have a very loose definition of video game and what it means to be a game and the idea of, you know, objectives and gameplay loops and, I don't know, winning. But speaking of games, let's not waste any more time and get to our guest of the show, who you may know from issue 37 of Indiepocalypse, enjoying its last week as the most recent issue, with Endless Ruin Chapter 1, Toward the Endless Ruin. It's Isabel Best. Isabel, how are you doing today?
Hey, I'm all right. How are you?
I'm doing good things, all things considered. I've got two little messages above you in the old Discord thing where I'm like, I gotta wait to hear from YouTube, but otherwise, I am here and ready for the show. And speaking of the show, to get the important question out of the way, to complete my informal survey of how I continue this thing every month, how did you hear about Indiepocalypse?
How did I hear about Indiepocalypse? I think I was just looking at stuff on Itch. And maybe, I don't know, you might have added one of my projects to a list or something. Maybe I was just like clicking random links on Itch and I was like, oh, what is this? This looks really cool. And then I kind of, you know, dug into it and I was like, oh, this is neat.
Cool. That is, I do add a lot of games to lists. I follow everyone that is in it, and then I use their recommendations to kind of, like, I'm very busy, so it's very convenient to let other people kind of do some soft curation for me, and then I go in later and be like, what are these games that I just add to a million little lists? And then sometimes developers do the work for me and just add their games. Well, that's a good thing. But speaking of adding games, tell me a little bit about Endless Ruin, Chapter 1, Toward the Endless Ruin.
Oh, God. What even is Endless Ruin? Oh. So I started the project as a concept album, or like a concept of a concept album.
Yeah.
Where I wanted to make a soundtrack for a video game that wasn't supposed to really exist. But then I started like developing, you know, backstory and world building for this fake video game. And somewhere in that process, I started playing around with Bitsy and I was like, oh, this is really easy to make little games in. What if I just made like a game about the game that I'm making the music about and then put the music into that? And so that became like, you know, Endless Ruin Chapter 1 is just the first track from this sort of album. So it's not the game, but it's a game about the game that the music about the game is about.
Right. A very roundabout way to be like, oh, you can make games kind of about anything. You know, it's kind of, it's a weird interactive medium. And that's, Bitsy is handy because it's, you can make it very quickly without like having to commit you know, weeks and weeks learning how to program. You can just kind of jump right in there.
Yeah, I like that immediacy a lot. You can kind of just jam with it.
Right. It's kind of like the equivalent of, in musical sense, to just being able to use an instrument instead of being like, I want to play guitar. Well, I better build the guitar first. There's a benefit to these kind of like, I've been thinking more of engines in that sense of like, you know, that they are pre-existing tools, like any other art form has pre-existing tools, and it'd be strange not to use them often.
Yeah, I think it's similar. Like, I used to make a lot of music on my computer, like in Fruity Loops and shit, and I would get so bogged down in like all the technical stuff and like, you know, programming everything. And I've shifted more towards using just little drum machines to make everything on, because it's much more like immediate and I can just hit some buttons and make something happen. And yeah, Bitsy, I think, feels a little like that for making games.
Yes, one second. Let me adjust something. There you are. Adjust my microphone down. Yes, I've adjusted my microphone down. Hopefully that is a good adjustment of microphone. I must have adjusted it when you use it, because I don't think I moved this. But anyway, sorry, I got distracted by a rare technical difficulty. but there is like a, because you can kind of get bogged down in, you know, perfectionism. And like this idea that I have to do everything, every little bit by myself, you know, there, especially I think it's an issue with games often, where it's like, you know, you gotta the pejorative of, you know, Unity asset store stuff, when it's like, who's got time to model 8 million crates and chairs and tables and everything else when somebody else already did the work for you.
Yeah. I think I have this issue of like perfectionism after the fact, though, where I kind of like, I'm like, okay, I made this thing, I'm going to put it out in the world. And then like a week after, I'll be like, oh shit, I messed that up. But then I just try to like not think about it.
Right. I think the trickiest part, which you've already gotten past, is getting just like powering through and finishing the thing without getting mired in like your perfectionism, because you're always find imperfections after the fact. But then luckily it's a lot easier to go back and to look and say, I'm not going to go back and fix that, I already made it.
Yeah, I think I'm lucky in a way, and then I usually don't notice them until after the fact.
Yeah, that is a beautiful way to be a perfectionist, because it's the way that actually finishes things. As opposed to, you know, the 8-year perfectionist who's like, everything is perfect now, except I've learned too much over these 8 years. I have to spend another 8 years redoing all the things I didn't know in the first 8. And then you never finish anything.
Yeah. I get stuck in that from time to time. I think there were like probably a couple of years where I didn't put out any music or anything.
Right. Yeah, because you primarily come from, I would say, a background of music, Brad, likely, right?
Yes, yeah, definitely the main thing I'm interested in. And I kind of got, I started off making games like when I had like in elementary school, I had an ancient, even at the time, like Tandy laptop, like one of the first kind of portable computers. No hard drive or anything, just 2 floppy drives. Yeah. And I had QBasic on it. So, you know, I started off making little like QBasic text games that didn't really go anywhere. And QBasic had a sound command where you just type like sound, frequency and hertz, length in like milliseconds, and you could just make music that way. So I'd like make little PC speaker songs and stuff. So I think for me, games and music are kind of tied together, but I definitely like with making Endless Ruin and some of the other little projects I've done recently, I'm just making games to make music for them.
Right. You kind of, a vehicle, like you said, to top a kind of a vehicle for imagined games. Which is like,
yeah. Like, I hope, I don't know. I don't consider myself that good at making games, but I hope that, like, if somebody plays one of my games, it kind of helps them imagine, like, a better game.
Right. There's, like, you know, there's a lot of merit to the concept, I think, of, like, a video game EP, you know? Not, like, an idea, a proof of concept of a game that doesn't have to be, like, a full, you know, the full, I mean, you can, that's why you can break up your games into chapters, you know, of, like, a per-song basis. It's almost like, you know, video game singles. Do they make video game singles? I wonder.
They should.
Yeah, like this idea of is that shareware? Is shareware video game singles, or like are those video game EPs? Maybe, I don't know.
Oh God! Now I'm thinking about those old, like, I don't know if this is something you remember, but the old, like, bargain bin CD-ROMs of, like, 100 different shareware games or whatever.
Yes, yeah, I have, like, as a kid, it mystified me because there was, like, you would get a lot of games, but then these CDs have, like, 40 games on them, and I don't know why. And a lot of them are bad, and I don't want to play them. But a couple of them are cool, and I didn't, like, it was a weird publishing structure.
Yeah. I feel like that compilation format, you know, which is kind of like, it's kind of part of the cool thing I think Indiepocalypse is doing, like, where you just get, like, you kind of get a bunch of games that you might not otherwise even check out or know anything about.
Yeah, I wonder or even worry that people will be like, oh, why would I check out this thing? I don't know any of these developers. And I'm like, well, that's the point, that you don't know these developers. It's kind of like an entry point, like, and it has a lot of different approaches to it. Like yours, for instance, is the only, like, the only Bitsy game in there. And so someone might come in through, like a puzzle game or a horror game or a visual novel, and then be like, I've never played a Bitsy game before, but then they have one in this thing. And they figure, well, I bought it, might as well try it.
Yeah, it's cool. That's, God, it was one of those shareware discs, was how I first played this old spiderweb software RPG called Exile, Escape from the Pit, where you're like, it's this RPG where you, like, make a party and you're thrown into some, like, you know, prison that's like an underground cave with the whole society in it, and you have to, like, figure out how to escape from it, or, like, you know, do something with it, with, like, unifying people in this cave society. Anyway, that's like one of my that was one of my go-to inspirations, making Endless Ruin. So it's kind of cool, like, for that to come full circle in a way.
Yeah, it's, I didn't realize, I'm like, Spiderweb Soft, like, they still have a website? He's like, yes, because they are the early, if you got in early on, like, the bundle craze, you probably own 6 to 12 Spiderweb Soft games between, like,
yeah,
and Gene Forge and all those.
Yeah, I think he's still making games.
Yeah, coming soon, Gene Forge 2 Infestation Kickstarter. Oh no, it's currently kickstarting.
Hell yeah.
A remaster. Yeah, there's, like, and that is the interesting thing, I think, you get with this sort of, like, you get pockets of development, like, of this person who's been making these games, like, in their own vein for, like, forever. Since copyright 1994 to 2023, you know?
Yeah, that's wild.
And that's, like, such a cool thing that can exist, of these kind of, like, it's also why I try to focus and, you know, try to de-emphasize, like, you don't need to, you can survive and kind of do your own thing, and you don't have to always worry about whatever you know, the most popular thing of the day is. You don't need to be literally the most popular game to come out in a week to, you know, for people to play your game.
Yeah, I think that's a hard hurdle to overcome. Like in music and in games, it's like things have such a brief life. You know, if people even notice them at all, they notice them for like a week and then it's gone. And you kind of have to just be like, okay, well, you know, I'm going to make this thing and it's going to exist, you know, and maybe just be a flash. But it might also be like, you know, somebody might, like with those spiderweb games, somebody might come back to this, you know, 10 years later for all I know. Like the internet's kind of.
I was just talking to someone saying it's like, it's also not very reassuring to tell someone that they might have a long tail and not immediate success, to be like, hey, a decade from now, people are going to see the value of the thing you made. Just hold on for a decade.
And, you know, maybe somebody would be like, oh, yeah, I played this Endless Ruin thing like 10 years ago, and I had this kind of unrelated idea that it sparked, and that's why I made this other thing.
Right.
I don't know. I think that's cool.
Right, this idea of someone being like, oh, did you hear this Endless Ruin like kind of series of games or like this kind of video game album thing? And people are like, oh, that's really cool. And it's, and meanwhile, you sitting there 10 years like, why wasn't that really cool 10 years ago? But there's kind of nothing you could do about it. It's that weird longevity of art that I think sort of like interesting... like purposeful works tend to, you know, persevere longer than just popular ones.
Yeah, I've been, I don't know, maybe I'm getting too off topic, but
there's no off topic.
I've been like the last like year or so, I got really into gorge music, which is like mostly Japanese, like experimental dance music inspired by mountain climbing and rock climbing.
Okay.
And so it's a genre that was created like 2012, kind of like partly, you know, maybe a little bit as a joke. There's all this like mythology and stories behind it. And it's like 2010s, there were all this, you know, sort of, you know, vaporwave was big and all these kind of like micro genres were proliferating on the internet.
Yeah.
But Gorge kind of like, is one that kind of came and the scene stuck around, but it kind of lost visibility on the internet, I think, for a long time. And then like last year, there are a couple albums that came out that got some press. And then there's like, you know, Bandcamp dailies doing like articles about Gorge, and, you know, the music press is getting into Gorge, and all of a sudden Gorge is like, you know, this whole thing. But that was like, you know, that's 10 years after like, you know, everyone had started making gorge music, and a lot of people had just kept making it the whole time.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, that's the good reminder of, you know, something like whatever, like, you know, music blogs or, you know, Bandcamp daily, things like that. You forget. It's easy. Like once music, especially, it's somewhat better documented than games. But there's like, it's all art forms. Remember, like, what you see in your day-to-day of just like thinking that you follow music or games or anything is like probably what, like 1% of what people are actually making every day.
Oh yeah. I mean, you know, even what people are releasing out of what people are making.
Yeah. Yeah. And then even like the coverage, like of, even if you are like you're real, like really focused on the blogs every day, and you're just like, you're still getting a small percentage of what it is, especially when they start to like to feed into each other, and like something will get found here that gets covered over there, and it kind of gets circled around. It's like there's a lot of stuff. There's endless stuff, you know. One does not have enough time to keep up with like all. Like, even people have told me that, like, oh, there's too many games in the Apocalypse for me to play them all. And I'm like, that's only 10 a month. Like, that's not even a lot of them aren't even very long. But unfortunately, there's only 24 hours in the day, and it's good to sleep for at least good to 6 to 8 of them. And then we're stuck working for like another probably 6 to 8 of them. it doesn't leave that many day hours left, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I like having like the short kind of game experiences to jump between, though. I don't know if it's like, I feel like growing up with like arcades and like video game rentals and shit like that, I'm like, I was kind of, I don't know, maybe short attention span, where I just want to like, I want to, sometimes I just want to play a bunch of games, you know, really fast, but I might not want to stick to one game for more than like an hour.
Right, right. And then, listen, I'll be honest, a lot of games have a lot of bullshit in them. It's like, that probably like why, you know, doesn't necessarily need to be there, because there's like the current trend towards like every game has to kind of be your forever game, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So it's like, hey, get this DiGiorno pizza, you get 15 Assassin's Creed map packs. And then I'm like, I don't want 15 Assassin's Creed map packs. What if I just played a game and then finished it, and then I didn't play it again, and it was over?
Yeah, I think I feel very anti, like, cutscene, anti, like, I don't want to say I'm anti-dialogue. I mean, I guess the games I make are mostly dialogue. But, like, I feel like a lot of AAA games, there's just so much, and I'm like, I don't have time for that. I don't want to deal with that.
Right, and I realized, like, as I've grown older and thought more, like, you know, there was the general idea that video games have, you know, bad writing, and I think there's a lot of them do. I think they get kind of a bad rap. I think the video game's main problem is they have too much writing. They just have, like, they need a real editor to, like, cut them in half, because they just, like, dialogue just goes on for so long sometimes in scenes. I'm like, if this was a movie, the scene would never be this long. There's just, like, even if this was, like, you know, a novel, there would not be this much dialogue back to back in this.
I think there's something too to like leaving things kind of implicit, and I don't know, I think this can happen maybe even accidentally a lot of the times, so when you don't have the time or the resources to make a game where you're like expositing, you know, all the lore and stuff, you just kind of drop a few hints and just let the thing be its own thing. I feel like even like I don't know, stuff like the original Zelda game, right?
Yeah.
I remember playing that and being like, what is this even about? Like, I don't know. There's a little guy wandering around a map. There's all these mysterious creatures. You know, the manual probably explained. There's like a story thing at the beginning, but you can kind of skip that. And it's just the suggestion of this like strange world. And that, I feel like you lose that in a lot of, yeah, the like, if you're just like telling people exactly what's going on all the time.
Right. It's like, well, here's, I don't need 15 journal entries explaining your strange world. Like, that is not even a necessarily, I think, a video game problem. I think that's just a writing problem of, you don't need to always explain everything. How do I be polite to narrative designers and say, I don't think people care too much about lore in stories as much as people even say that they do. I think people tend to prefer, like, you know, characters and like how it affects people more than like what the names of your 15 types of elves are.
I like to have that kind of stuff, but just not unpack it at all.
Right. Yes, a lot of proper nouns without equivalent number of definitions of said nouns. Like, learn them contextually. There's a lot of, I've found from stories that I don't feel like I'm missing anything if I just like don't get a lot of it explained, but I understand how it relates to the characters in the world, so I don't need to know what all these things are like fully spelled out.
Yeah. I think when I started, you know, when I started working on ideas for Endless Ruin, I have like notes in my phone that are just lists of like the six axioms and the stages of cartographic power and all these things. I didn't even know what they were when I was writing them down. I'm like in bed on my phone, like half asleep. I'm like, oh, I got to write down these stages of cartographic power before I forget about them.
Yeah, I think especially with, and this is a personal preference, of course, but I think with especially kind of serialized or sort of long form continuous storytelling that's all told at once, I think a good writer knows how to just make up bullshit and then come back to it later and be like, oh, wait a minute, how can I expand on this that I, you know, when you didn't initially have a plan for it, it's just kind of like cool ideas or words that you came up with. And then like contextualizing them after the fact.
Yeah, I remember, I don't know if this is apocryphal or not. I just remember reading something about how, you know, Robert E. Howard, the guy who wrote the Conan the Barbarian stories, wanted to write historical fiction at one point, but realized like how much work it was doing all this research and no one was paying for it. And he was kind of like, well, I could just kind of make up shit and people are paying for these pulp stories, so I'll just do that.
Right. And then you don't have to worry about being correct because you've made everything that's correct. You're you are the historian. You're the primary source.
Yeah, yeah. There's a freedom in that.
And then, yeah. And then you can, like, as like the more you write and the more you realize, like, you kind of like build out this toolbox, and then you're like, well, I need this character's, I need this weird, I need an evil wizard for something. And then suddenly, like, said evil wizard has like way more context given to them because they need to fit into this plot of this point in the story, and like how you kind of wrap all those things together, you just kind of like naturally build it just by nature of, you know, doing additive work.
Yeah, yeah.
It's also, like, I think the fun of not building to, like, an end point trying to think of how I want to phrase this. Building an endpoint from the beginning, not like building a beginning from an endpoint, because then it can feel like the stuff you build is like clearly, it feels empty. It feels like, oh no, this is just actually just clearly in service of getting to whatever your end plot point is, you know?
Yeah, I feel like as a writer, I never figured out how to do like plot or plan things. I don't know. I think that's, you know, I did poetry a lot because I didn't have to worry about where a thing was going in the same way.
Right, right. It's like, what a, I don't envy anyone who tries to get into poetry. I don't know, for whatever I've heard, for whatever market has, whatever market in medium you think has a bad, poetry has got it worse. In terms of, there's no money in it, but it's.
Yeah, I wouldn't recommend. There's no money, and it's extremely cutthroat for that no money.
Yes, yeah, it's a bunch of people, like, just tearing through each other for $5, but that $5 is the only $5 you're gonna get that year. But it's still like a. Showing the ebb and flow of, you know, mediums, you know? Poetry used to be hot shit. We learned about it in school. Like, we're supposed to, like, it's still extremely relevant. There's someone fighting that fight within the, at least I think they still are, within the American school system that's like, hey, poetry is important.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think, I think music's kind of going that way, too, with Spotify and all the streaming services.
Yeah.
And the way it shifted the culture, like, I don't have any of my music on any streaming services. It's just on Bandcamp for the most part.
Right.
And when I mention that to people, sometimes they'll be like, oh, well, can I stream it, you know, on my, like, my Echo Dot or whatever? And I'm like, no, you have to, like, you can listen to it on there. You can buy the record and then I get money. And they're like, buy a record?
Yeah, it's an increasingly foreign concept. It also, like, yeah, I get what you're saying, because it does, like, I've noticed it really also skews, I think, how people approach music. Because just the idea of buying a record, a collection of songs constructed into an album, feels increasingly, like, foreign, this idea. Like, the algorithm loves playlists and hates albums. And it's very clear when you interact with it that it operates like that.
Yeah, there was a big thing in ambient music for a bit, because, you know, ambient's like, there's never been much money in ambient music. But then Spotify was making these playlists for, like, sweeping.
Yeah.
And those got popular. So then artists who got put on those playlists were like, you know, oh shit, I made $10 this month.
Whoa. So that's what, like 10 million plays, I think? Something like
that? Yeah.
Yeah, there is. It's this kind of, yeah, there is. It's this kind of very strange approach to, like, I found when I started trying the voice thing on my phone to play music, and it goes with the weirdest choices. That is clearly, like, I feel like I see the underpinnings of how it decides things by, like, how it picks songs and that kind of thing. It's like weird album selections, or just, like, is not clearly not pulling what I want to pull, and it's very strange, and I don't know, I don't like it. But I'm a weird mixed stream person who then buys a lot of music because, I don't know, I like getting, like, I don't know, it's convenient. I'm a victim of the convenience, you know?
Yeah, I feel like, you know, it's almost everybody is. There was like at the start of the pandemic in 2020, World's End girlfriend, Katsuhiko Maeda, who's a Japanese artist, does, like, post-rock kind of stuff and runs Virgin Babylon Records, started releasing, what did they call it? They were releasing stuff to listen to while you're asleep, just kind of minimalist music, like with the specific request of, like, oh, stream this on Spotify on repeat while you're asleep so that, you know, we can get money to pay artists for the label.
Right. Yeah, and then you hear, like, things about, like, it's a very... strange, like, increasingly, like, strange medium of, or, you know, even just, like, the idea of, you know, catering a song to TikTok, you know, or, like, the idea of, you know, TikTok blowing up random songs out of nowhere, or, like, because you that's monetized as well, right, when people use your music, I think.
I don't even know how that works with TikTok. Yeah, I never heard of anyone getting royalties from any of that, but...
I thought... Maybe it's just, like... Because I thought... I don't... There's... I don't have time for a lot of social media. TikTok is chief among them. Because...
I don't know.
You have to... You know what it is? It's the media... I don't like the medium. The way... People are like, it's like someone looked at Vine and is like, what if we made this more irritating and took all the fun out of it? And that is like, I don't need people pointing at things and explaining things to me in my life anymore.
Well, and now with kind of tying everything back to games, you know, Bandcamp, which is the main kind of platform for buying records digitally, now got bought last year by Epic.
Right.
And now Bandcamp is curating Fortnite playlists. And so that just got announced. But in the announcement, there's like nothing about royalties. So I don't know. Maybe they like worked out individual deals with the artists on these playlists. But as far as I know, there's like no royalty structure. And now Bandcamp is just kind of this pool of reserve music that Epic can pull into Fortnite.
Yeah, that was I originally, because I believe Epic also bought Harmonix. And I assumed that's why they bought Bandcamp. Because it'd be like, we have this company that makes music. Yes, Epic did buy Harmonix. So I'm like, we have this video game music company. What if we just bought a music company? And I assumed that they were just going to plug it in there. And then similarly, like you said, royalties, ? How does that work?
Yeah. I'm like, oh, did I just spend the last 10 years composing music for Fortnite?
Right.
Oops.
Is there going to be a new rock band that comes out and now... suddenly there's a clause in the Bandcamp agreement that says, oh yeah, we can put all your music in Rock Band or whatever.
Yeah, I don't know. I used to just put all my stuff on Internet Archive, and I feel like I think about that a lot these days. I'm like, what if I just, you know, stopped using all these platforms and stopped really worrying about social media and promoting things in any way and just started uploading everything to a folder on Internet Archive. And, you know, maybe somebody will find it one day and maybe not.
I think somebody will, because I like to think that even no matter how many people will buy whatever your latest favorite platform is, there's always going to be someone out there who is like, well, I've got to dig deeper, you know, I just can't adhere to whatever the platform has to say. I have to find some weird record that I pulled out of a bin somewhere that's some self-recorded thing from the late 70s. And it's, wow, it's my new favorite thing. And then it kind of becomes a new cult favorite. And that is the same. The Internet Archive just makes that a lot easier because you don't have to like physically be somewhere. You don't have to worry about... physical deterioration of something.
Yeah, it's great. I think too, like, I think a lot of people don't look for music on there unless they're looking for like Grateful Dead tapes, of which there's like a billion. But there's a lot of, you could just find like random, you know, random music and like podcasts people made that like two people have ever listened to. And like, I don't know. I love that shit.
Yeah. There was a point where people were like, wow, they were like, it was the you know, someone's like, oh, this Weather Channel music slaps, it's like sick. And I was like, well, I just went to archive.org and I just like, let me just download, because obviously someone has that archived, all these like interstitials. So I just go there and I download it, because, you know, people archive stuff in like the, I think people forget sometimes that there's like things exist beyond a post is a weird way of saying it. Like the idea that if someone's like, yeah, this is sick, this does sound like JRPG boss music, and then, but there isn't like the connection to be like, of course they made 80 other songs for that and they're available online.
Yeah. Lately, my thing has been downloading big, like arcade ROM sets, and a lot of them have sort of not super helpful file names, and they're not documented. So I'll just make a spreadsheet and document, like, you know, everything, like all the data I can get about a game in a couple of minutes of loading it up, and like that scratches my itch of playing a bunch of arcade games for like 5 minutes a piece. And my other unrelated itch of making complicated spreadsheets.
Listen, if you have an itch to make complicated spreadsheets, that is always a doubly satisfying itch to find a way to scratch, because it's not always easy to invent a complicated spreadsheet for yourself.
Yeah. I made one not long ago for programming a particular FM synth, so you can make FM 4-op FM synth patches in a Google sheet, and then I haven't figured out how to convert it into SysX so you can actually upload it into a synth yet, but that's what I'm working on.
See, there's I'm so far from this, but it's always so exciting just to hear, like, the because I realized another thing, like, you know, growing up, it's like I don't need to know everything, and it frees you to realize that you don't need to know everything, and then you can just be like, let other people know stuff for you and let them tell you about it without ever having to. I got excited when I realized that FUBAR has different MIDI instruments. And I was like, huh. And it makes different sounds. And they're like, wait a minute, MIDI? That's as far as I got, though.
Yeah, Bitsy has a sequencer in it now that's really fun that I've been excited about.
What a beautiful engine. Just like, especially because it's like, my favorite thing is probably just because it's super, so low weight, you know? I think people often forget that computers are big and expensive and not everyone has access to them.
Yeah. I did a little game jam project on there over the holiday. I was traveling with my girlfriend to see her parents, and she just had her laptop. So I just borrowed it and, you know, was able to just use the browser interface and was like, you know, composing little songs in the Bitsy sequencer when I didn't have, like, you know, any of my normal stuff.
Yeah, there's so much, like, I just get very excited about people, like, you know, potential for different mediums and just, like, ease to access, because, you know, you get a lot of crap when people get, when tools get democratized, but you know what, you need, also, one, it like having a lot of crap doesn't really take away from anything just by existing. But also, you get a lot of people who like would usually not have the time or the resources to commit to, you know, building everything from scratch. That's a cool thing.
Yeah, I love that accessibility, and also the like. I don't know, there's a bunch of like offshoots of Bitsy now that I haven't even checked out, but just the idea that some people are like building their own kind of related tools and building in all their own idiosyncrasies and things.
Right. That you can be like you can have like, you, if you really want to get complicated with Bitsy, you can through like, you know, Bitsy 3D or whatever, Bipsy, I think, and all these other kind of Bitsy likes or Bitsy hacks that exist.
Yeah, I remember, it's like a million years ago, but I was really into, at the time, this thing called granular synthesis, which is just like a method for making noise where you take a sound and you chop it up into little bits, into little grains, and you just kind of rearrange them and randomize them, and you can make lots of weird noises and stuff. But around this time, like, in a band with this guy, Tyler, and he's like, hey, I met this guy, I don't know, at work or something. You know, he's got a house. He's kind of like, he doesn't talk much, but he's got all these like really interesting ideas about music. He invited me over to jam sometime. He was like, I don't want to go over there by myself. Will you go over there with me? And I'm like, yeah, okay. So we go over to this guy's house. And, you know, we get to talking about music, and he's got like a little synth setup, you know, that's kind of cool. And we start talking about granular synthesis, and he's like, oh, wait, I've got this thing. And so he goes into another room, and he's gone for a minute, and he comes back into his living room, and he's got this like, it's like the keyboard part of an old chord organ with the chord organ part removed. And then each of the keys is attached to like a lever, and there's various lengths of wind chimes hung from each lever. And he's like, I made my own analog granular synth where like you press a key and it just hits a bunch of wind chimes together kind of at random. And I'm like, this is the shit. Like the fact that people are just like, kind of like, you know, taking this kind of idea, but then just tinkering with it and making their own weird thing. And it's super easy to play, but like, you know, somebody had to like physically build all this stuff.
Right, right. That is, a thing that nobody, how many of those exist in the world? One?
Yeah, I actually never, after that day, I never saw that guy again. So I have no idea, like, I hope he's out there still playing that wind chime keyboard.
Right, right. There's out there somewhere. So hopefully there still exists one in the world. And maybe, who knows, this will put it in someone's brain to be like, what if I made some my own kind of weird homebrew instrument? Because that's one of the secrets about instruments is that none of them actually grow on trees. We made them all. We made them all up. So
yeah, it's kind of like a game when you think about it.
Yeah, no one's stopping you from making a new one. There's just like these things that make sounds, and a lot of things in life make sounds. Pretty much anything really will make a sound if you try hard enough. It's just turning that into like a workable instrument that can like be played semi-reliably is the tricky part, I say. Or anything that makes a sound can make music. If you're have got a willing enough audience, perhaps.
Yeah, I remember playing a basement noise show and someone was drumming with drumsticks on the like ventilation ducts going across the ceiling in the basement.
Yeah. Yeah, there's once you take the dive into just like whatever genre, subgenre of that exists within noise, you're like, oh wait, music does not have music like anything else doesn't have a lot of no outer limit to like what the rules of it are, you know? There's just like an understanding of this, like you kind of go by feel, and rules, I guess, in any medium are a tricky thing because, you know, they're good to have, but also good to break and ignore.
Yeah, I think that gets interesting with games because, you know, in games you sort of, I don't know if games are rules, but they're sort of, you know, often constructed around rules. And then it's like, how do you get out of that?
Right. And like the players themselves will intentionally attempt to break rules in ways that games do not anticipate. So there's also that curiosity as a developer of like anticipating a desire to break rules or creating an openness where perhaps like rules feel less strict. And like it's this kind of like interesting relationship between something that is like... like I could, if I wanted to, watch a movie by like watching 10 minutes, pausing it, fast forwarding 50 minutes, watching another 6 minutes, rewinding it 20 minutes. You know, I could watch a movie like that, but it's
that's a good idea.
It's a very strange way to watch a movie, and not intuitive. But you can do your any percent speed runs of movies as well.
Yeah, I kind of want to try that now. I watched this, last night I watched this French surrealist film by Raul Ruiz called City of Pirates. And there's a lot of like just pastiche and images that are kind of like jarring. And I'm just thinking about some of that, like, you know, French fantastique and new wave cinema. And like, oh yeah, I guess you could take like, I don't know, whatever Ant-Man movie or whatever and just chop it up in a really weird way and like kind of steamed hams it.
Yeah, I was realizing, I was wondering with a friend, and I think I talked about this last week, about the idea of within streaming services, I wonder if movies ought to have some kind of like surrealist or just like weird shit tag, because like both for, to be polite, not to be deploy, because I would love people who are not expecting it to dive into it. But for me, who is sometimes looking for that, because you can read a, you know, if you go on Amazon and read a description of something, it's like, you know, what is the log line of on whatever streaming service of City of Pirates, you know, it's probably just like, oh, it's a movie in which things happen. And you're like, it does not convey often like the visual approach or like any kind of like narrative non-linearity or abstraction that happens in movies. It's on Mubi. Mubi's got my back. Thank you. Sorry, I was looking up the movie after you said that because I've.
Oh yeah, yeah. There's like Mubi and Tubi and Roku and etc.
Okay, so that's the fun thing about kind of like old obscure. Or like semi-obscure, or just kind of, you know, I mean, that kind of fiction is like sometimes they're literally on every single streaming platform, sometimes they're on none of them.
Yeah, it can get really weird too. I was, what were we trying to watch? We were trying to watch some like 2010s anime called Monster.
Yeah.
And it's on Netflix, but Netflix has like a little less than half the episodes. And right. They're encoded really weird, so they're, like, blurry.
Yeah.
And it's like, why is this on here? But then also, like, if somebody encounters this the first time through this, then it's this whole other, like, thing, which is kind of like, it kind of sucks on one level, but it's kind of interesting on another. Like, is this a new thing now?
Right. It's super, and it's like, that is a perfect example, because Monster is like a classically, or not classically revered, because it's not very old, but like a very, you know, Naoki Urasawa is not an unknown author, you know.
Yeah.
But there are these weird little things that are just like unavailable, you know. I remember when I was like, let me see what this whole Captain Beefheart has to say about this Troutbacks replica, and it's like not available anywhere at all. Unless you like know where to look, kind of thing. It's like one of those things. It's like, it's easy to learn about, and people will talk about casually. But it's like, not. It's one of those things where it's like you can buy it for an old pressing on eBay for like $80. That kind of thing.
Yeah.
Or it's like, hey, or it's like the film equivalent. Like, oh, you can get this movie. I have a friend who got a Blu-ray player that has a region switcher, because some things are just like, oh, this movie you can only get in like region 1 or 2 or whichever region we are not.
Yeah, and it's not just streaming too. Like I don't know, there's so many games now that are, you know, hard to find or unplayable, and like even like books, like publishing and translation. I got into a while back reading stuff by Fernand Deligny, who's a French kind of anti-psychiatry, post-psychoanalysis theorist. And there's some stuff of his work translated in English. But I wanted to look at, I don't speak French, but I wanted to look at the original French on some of it to just kind of compare and look at how it's being translated. And the stuff that's published in English isn't published in French anywhere. And then the stuff that's published in French isn't translated into English.
Yeah.
And it's like, shit.
Right. Especially once you find like the thrill of, you know, when translation is a whole other thing, because we have somewhere along the line, I don't know why we just had to have all these different languages and complicate things like that, but we have all of these different languages, and then suddenly it's like, oh, well, I can spend years of my life learning a language, or I can just hope that someday somebody will translate this thing or subtitle it or something, you know?
Yeah, it's like, oh, well, I guess I'll move to France.
Yeah.
I guess.
Right. Do immersive translation practice. And... like eventually, and then eventually so I can read one book, and what if I don't like it? That'd be unfortunate.
Yeah.
And that, like, that also is, like, one of the biggest things that I think hurts independent work, especially, because who is going to translate, you know, an independent novel published on the web, you know, who's, I guess in that case you can machine translate it, which is ultra imperfect, but still technically doable. But for more like pain in the ass mediums, like a game, for instance, like how do you explore a game that you can't just like plug a text file and get a sloppy machine translation version of it? Unless I guess you can probably pull text files from there if you're clever enough.
Yeah, I feel like there's a lot of SNES games I played back in the day that were like fan translations of stuff that wasn't, you know, originally released in English.
Yeah.
And like, I don't know, the people who like do that and who did that back then, it's like, it's so like, it's so much work and there's so much like dedication to like bringing even just like one or two games to people.
Right. And it's this weird kind of like, it's a very strange like dedication and craft, because you are, in a lot of ways, you are preserving an art form. It's kind of like tending a garden you'll never get to eat from, that somebody else will probably harvest from later. It's a weird thing.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if I spend like a lot of time, you know, translating Bahamas Lagoon for the SNES, and then eventually Square Enix is like, oh, the U.S. seems to really like this game, let's release it over there in a remastered version or whatever. It's like built on the back of kind of like legally dubious fan translations, but nonetheless built on that back. And it's a very strange thing.
Did they re-release Bahamut Lagoon?
They did not, no.
Okay, I was just like, I had a moment of, oh shit, did that happen?
No. Live Alive is definitely feels like it is of that vein to some extent, but I think that is also more respected in Japan, maybe, and that's what did it. And then
and
everything's an international market now. Or else you
gotta make that money,
right? Or else you just don't release it. No, I that would be a, I don't know if I think Bahamas Lagoon is like tier three SNES RPG in terms of like what people are ready for and looking for, with no disrespect to Bahamas, with all, and I say that with all respect for Bahamas Lagoon.
Yeah, I feel like those solid, like, not the best tactics game, but not the worst.
Yeah. There's, oh sorry, Bahamut Lagoon. I don't know why I always what's the word I'm looking for? Make it a possessive. Or maybe the original, like, ROM I got a million years ago was a possessive and it just burned into my brain. But yeah, I think there's like, there's something in there of like to really doing deep dives of like a million little games that are not like the classically canonical series, or just like the idea of, because I've been working through movies like that I've bought or have been gifted over the years that I have like, you know, have been piling up. I was like, you know, it's finally time to go full movie mode and just watch one of these a night. And I've been watching, like, working my way through, like, the Zatoichi box set I was gifted some many years ago. And it's not, like, it's not high art, but it's cool. And there are definitely entries where it's, like, gets extra cool. And it's, like, it's nice that, like, you can get an old like 60s serialized character driven work that, like, why else, like, it is, what else would bring that kind of thing to like have a nice beautiful kind of like HD resolution version available in the US besides like someone's curiosity to like it's having a certain degree of like completionist is like neat.
Yeah. I had a roommate at one point who worked at a video rental place at like when they were getting rid of, you know, all the VHS they had like remaining in the back room or whatever. And he ended up with all of them and just had stacks and stacks of like old VHS tapes. And that was the, after a while, like, you know, everyone in the house, we just like watch a random VHS every day.
Yeah, there's, we once got like a Right Stuff had like, hey, they ran a thing, was like, you get a free, spend $70 or whatever and get a free blind box of just random anime. And so we get like these, maybe this weird movie or like season or like disc two of something. And it's like, a lot of these are trash, but there's like something to have. You know what it is? The word I was looking for is the context. It's nice to have like the context of it all.
Yeah, and sometimes you really stumble on something. I saw the first time I saw Videodrome, it was in that stack of VHS tapes, and I didn't know like anything about Videodrome. I'm just like, oh, weird VHS tape, and it's, you know, it's a weird VHS tape about VHS tapes,
right?
And it just kind of like, it really heightened the experience. Like, I feel like that was the perfect like situation for viewing Videodrome the first time.
Yeah. Now he is very, Cronenberg is very much like a, you know, Cronenberg has like six movies in the Criterion Collection, you know? He's entered this kind of like revered status for just like weird, his very particular dedication to body horror and like this kind of half schlocky, half like serious sort of approach to filmmaking. And I think you lose that sometimes if you don't like have someone sticking around and like, you know, digging through piles of VHSs.
Yeah, I think that made that movie seem, I don't know, more like, I don't want to say profound, but just like it really resonated.
Yeah. There's also a lot to the importance of like finding something on your own, you know?
Yeah, like, I think if I encountered it through, like, you know, on the Criterion Channel or something, it just wouldn't, like, it wouldn't have stuck with me in the same way.
Right, because your expectations aren't, like, met the same way. Or, like, it's no longer a random thing, like, oh, this movie's going to be doing something, you know?
Yeah,
I think there's, like, I recently, kind of like you were saying, going through just a bunch of arcade games, I played through, like, not played through, but I casually played the entire US NES library, and I was realizing like how many games are very similar to Zelda 2 and how many games are cut from a very same cloth. And like, I think it's interesting to go beyond just like the canonical entries in anything and like also try out their contemporaries to see like maybe they were important or like how many things were of this cloth, and then you might find like a bunch of other interesting things that are like, oh, it turns out like this approached to this a lot more, even if it is not like the one that got canonically passed down.
Yeah, it's interesting. People talk about there's so many games to play these days, and you know, the whole concept of the indie apocalypse, right? That there's like too many indie games. But then, yeah, you look at that NES library, and it's like there's a lot of games in there.
Yeah,
and a lot of like weird stuff too. Like,
yeah, there's there. Yes, there is. even something like what is it? I don't know. Actually, I want to call it Monster Party, but I don't think it's Monster Party. Or is it Monster Party? The thing with the guy, he's already dead. No, what is?
Yeah, that? I think it's Monster Party.
Yes, it is. That super goofy, like, human entertainment game. That it has, like, this very weird sense of humor and, like, a real goofiness, a real playfulness to it. And there's, like, I don't know why I own this as a kid, but there's a Total Recall game on the NES. And it does something super cool in, like, the beginning where, like, I've only seen the movie once, half at a party, but there's a scene where, or I don't know if there's a scene, but there's a part in the game where, like, a guy's coming up the stairs and you can see in the background of, like, video cameras of, like, elevators and someone entering and exiting two elevators, and it's super cool, like, presentationally, but it's, like, also buried within, like, a very average tie-in game for Total Recall on the NES.
Yeah, sometimes, you know, I'm sure, like, working on games like that, you just gotta find, like, your little space where you can experiment inside of, you know, whatever. What's probably, like, a really crushing job, you know, is having you do.
Yeah, and like, I even only played strictly the, like, you know, the US. There's, like, even more games if you look at, like, the Famicom or the Famicom Disk System. There's, like, the secret of the indie apocalypse, and this applies to, like, all mediums, is as of right now, as of speaking, if all art stopped being produced, if you no longer had to work or eat or sleep, and you could commit 24 hours to consuming art, not even thinking about it after the fact, just simply raw consumption of art, you would not have enough time within human lifespan to experience it all, you know.
Yeah, that's cool. I like that.
So it's like, we're already from the start, from the get-go, before games were invented, there's been too much art. So you, it's about, I think that's why curation is important. It's about kind of like finding what you want to try and, like, your particular niches. Partially the disappointing part of, I'm sure most fields, but games especially, it feels like criticism has often given way to all the criticism outlets are mostly like entertainment outlets now. They're like streaming, and it's more about like playing, you know, the games dictate the coverage rather than the other way around.
Yeah, it's so hard. I have a little music blog where I don't even post on it that often, but I'm just like, you know, I just talk about stuff I've heard that I like, but it's like, there's so few of like, even like music blogs like that anymore, or they're out there, but they're like hard to find, and everything's like, you know, everyone reads like Pitchfork and Bandcamp Daily.
Right, right. And having one of those things also be a storefront. Is like there's some dubiousness to it. I think it there's good in that, like, generally the Johnny on the street listening to music is not gonna encounter like Peruvian goth music, but
I think I see it like old this, you know, the CD warehouse in town would have like the employees pick area, and that's like fine. It's just that when they did that, it wasn't like one of two or three like outlets for music criticism and journalism that people actually engaged with.
Right. Usually there was like outlets that got you to that CD warehouse in the first place, and not just the CD warehouse was also the outlet, and there were others. Yeah. It's a hard time to be a critic when, everyone can be a critic. Because it's just words you write on a page, and people, I think people undervalue that it's hard to be good at writing words. They just assume that because you can write words, you can be good at it. There isn't that same barrier to entry where it's very obvious if you don't know how to play a piano, for instance.
I kind of like that sound, though.
Yeah, no, that weird joke album where John Benjamin played jazz very poorly is kind of funny and kind of interesting. But anyway, we are actually, I just looked over for a second. We're actually over an hour, and I try to keep these things within an hour, reasonably taken. But sometimes, you know, you just get in a conversation, you just keep going.
Hey, you know, I'm just a really interesting guest.
Yes, you know, there is always a deep fear that when I wind up with a solo guest session that it will be a guest that's hard to talk to. And so far, full perfect batting average. No guest in which I am like, oh boy. So very glad to have you here.
Yeah, it was fun.
We have one question here before. My God, someone, speaking of people playing things, someone just a second ago was playing. Okay, maybe he's, I don't know if he's playing. There's a game called Conquest of the Crystal Palace that has a lot of cool designs in it. And it's one of those like NES games where it's like a perfectly fine platformer, but like there's a shop and you can go like, it also has like a news section, and then the shop girl turns into like a news anchor and tells you about the plot. It's neat.
Oh yeah, I'm looking at it. I like these very Rygar-like textures.
Yes. Oh, Rygar. If I can go on a mild divergence as I'm trying to close the show, I think one of the reasons, there's a lot of reasons why I don't like people calling pixel art retro, because it's silly. It's a stupid term that people use for most primarily games, but very little like modern pixel art actually looks like, you know, actual old pixel art. Like stylistically, it doesn't look like it at all. Like there's a different stylistic approach. Ignoring even that, of course, you know, particular artists will have particular styles that shows through their art. But like a lot of modern pixel art does not look like color palette wise or just like design wise aesthetically like old pixel art. And there's like, I don't know. That's why it's still cool to go back and play like NES games, because they don't even in like a world full of pixel art, they still don't look like modern games.
Yeah.
There's too many cowards unwilling to make Rygar textures in their platformers. I had a point that I was going to, but I forgot what it was. It doesn't really matter. Games look cool. Oh, you know what it was? It's in one of those like big Final Fantasy hardcover like art history whatever books where they show you side by side like his original like you know, gorgeous painterly sketches designs of what these monsters and characters look like, and like the shockingly faithful like 32x32 pixel constructions of those designs. And it's like fascinating to see how people were like, really, like, wow, you could do a lot with like very little.
Yeah, it's kind of like magic to me.
Yeah, like one of them, I think it's FF Dot, actually has like grids, like in some of their art actually has like broken up into grids. So theoretically, you could take open that book and open like a sprite or whatever and recreate those characters just by like following their grids. And it's neat. But
yeah.
But before we go, we've got a a standard our weekly question that Mochi has to know. Isabel, do you have a favorite Toho character?
Oh gosh, I don't know. I'm so unfamiliar with Toho, but I'm not like deeply familiar with Toho. I get part of it is like I get photosensitive migraines and stuff. Yes. So some of that like kind of stuff I can't really. I mean, I can engage with it, but it's like I have to really pay the price.
Yeah, there's if you're playing like not fan games and just like mainline Toho. Ass Toho. There's a lot going on in those games.
Yeah, like I'm a big fan of like shmups and stuff, but I have to like, or even just like going through cataloging arcade games. Last night I hit some like Batman, like Michael Keaton Batman game.
Okay.
And it did something, and I was like, oh god, I have to stop now.
I thought there's one Batman game. I think it's like the Saturn Batman Forever that looks nuts. Is like a visual nightmare. It's like a, I forget what it is, but it's like Batman Forever, it's Batman and Robin, obviously, because Robin's in it. But it's like digitized sprites, and it's a nightmare to look at, but like beautiful in its own weird way. So is that a long way to say you do not?
Yeah, I don't think I have I would know who my favorite would be.
Right, perfect. No, I don't expect everyone to know. When I first started getting that question every week, I was unfamiliar with Toho characters. I am becoming more familiar. Asking the question every week piques my curiosity, especially when people have an answer. Because I'm like, huh. And it's also like this weird blind spot of like, you know, super important game design, sort of, or like highly influential, and like just like the whole, you know, how it presents itself, and its whole like, I don't know, like, you know, free use sort of structure that it has. Also, like whenever I see that guy Zune, he seems like he's having a good time. He's always got a beer, and I'm like
yeah, that's important.
It seems like, yeah, I want to, this year I've been trying to have more of a good time and stress out a lot less. And because that's more like my natural state, like, is just to be, drink two beers, eat too much pizza, and fall asleep on a friend's couch. It's more like I'm not really like a high strung business guy, but I tricked myself into thinking I had to be for this whole project. And I'm realizing that sucks and I should stop. But
I hope things get more like chill and fun with it for you.
Yeah, they are. And I've stopped, and it's probably gonna like maybe I reaped the sowing of stressed out Andrew's work, and like whatever work needed to get done within that time frame is getting done. But I'm just going to relax. And I don't think it's going to hurt me too much.
Yeah, I think that's a good place to be.
Aside from this current thing, which technically I'm only stressing about, like, it's not a thing that does not happen if something doesn't get done. It just happens later. And part of me is worried about, like, hey, if it just happens later, that's fine, so long as it happens, you know?
Yeah, I'm currently planning an album release, and some things are delayed, which is, like, fine, and I'm just kind of like, it'll come out when it comes out. Things will get done when they get done. I'm not going to stress about it.
Right. It also does not hurt that I got a job I hate a lot less, that pays a lot more, and I do have to do a lot more less work.
Oh, hell yeah.
In, like, the recent months, which is, like, you forget how it's kind of like whenever people talk about things. Yes, actually, if people had more money, everything becomes a lot easier.
Yeah, that is true.
Like, you realize that, oh, all the stress you've given yourself, it's like, oh, I need to find all the reasons for this. And then it's like you realize, oh, a very important reason is I just had less money. and suddenly having more money, even if it's like not a lot more, but just like a little bit more, meaning a little bit more. It's like, oh, all those problems that I was trying to attribute to a bunch of other things in my life, turns out it might have just been money. or having a little more money alleviates those problems anyway. So, like, sucks to you if you're rich and miserable, I guess. What are you doing?
Yeah.
But to be rich. What I would do is probably just pay people more money. I don't understand how you can, like, what the point is of hoarding wealth. It doesn't do anything. Money doesn't do anything.
Yeah.
But there was just the other day a cover artist who I could not afford, and if I had more money, I could be like, yeah, I could do that. No problem. I'll give you as much money as you need. But to end this thing, to end this show, finally, Isabel, before we go, I gotta know, if people are looking to get your stuff, you know, it's a podcast, ostensibly, under duress. I wanted it to be just like a live show, but I was like, fine. I guess podcasts are things that people listen to after the fact. And this is the part where you tell people where they find your stuff.
Oh, yeah. So I guess games and some of my writing, some of my poetry, you can get on itch.io. What is it? Let me look.
I have it posted in the chat. The Twitch chat is. I just don't know how to say it.
Oh, yeah. Thanks. It's akeensense.itch.io. I know it's a little pun. I used to be an archaeobotanist, so it's a little pun about like akeens, like sunflower seeds.
Yeah. And for the pun unaware and the non-botanist, that akeen is spelled A-C-H-E-N-E.
Yeah, and then just S-E-N-S-E sense. And then if you want to look at my music, it's just it's isabelbess.bandcamp.com. I can put it.
Got it. Got you covered in there.
Yeah, and that's where you can find like most of my stuff. I put out a lot of tracks on like anthologies and stuff like that. So, you know, you can just... You can look for those. They're kind of, it's like a little quest I can send you on, I guess.
Right. And then you can go out there, listen to those albums to the point where Bandcamp is like, you gotta buy this now. And then you're like, I suppose I will.
Yeah. You know, think of it like an augmented reality game.
Yeah. I've hit that a couple times and I'm like, I suppose you got me, Bandcamp. That's how you know when it's time to fully abandon Bandcamp is when they don't do that anymore.
Yeah.
That's when you know you get to jump ship and start to look to, like, let's all start selling it back on our own web. I mean, I'm a big fan of having your own website in general. I think it's important. I think it's a cool thing to do. But it's also a little trickier to, like, right? Anyway, I caught myself again. But before, thank you, Isabel, for being here, for chatting with me, for making the games, for including the games, for, you know, general, you know, thanks for hanging around and making art.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. It was really fun.
Yeah, I this is my opportunity to... I don't go out especially this year, I'm just like, hey, I'm not traveling to any conventions. And then next year, I'll probably still be like, if they're expensive, I'm still not going to them. So I will very rarely see people, but this is my way to talk with people. And kind of, when I get better at scheduling and don't fall behind, it's also a way to get people in the same room together that would similarly not travel. But anyway... final goodbyes. Thank you. I forgot to go change my little screens because I didn't have a break this time, so I have to get everything ready. but I've got everything ready. So thank you so much for being here. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for doing Indiepocalypse.
Thank you.